Osho, Philosophia Perennis, Volume 1. National, Pune, India. Discourse number 1.
Bhagwan, render to the immortal gods the consecrated cult. Guard then thy faith. Revere the memory of the illustrious heroes of spirits demigods. Be a good son, just brother, spouse tender, and good father. Choose for thy friend the friend of virtue. Yield to his gentle counsels, profit by his life, and for a trifling grievance, never leave him. If thou canst at least, for a most rigid law binds power to necessity.
Pythagoras represents the eternal pilgrim for Philosophia Perennis, the perennial philosophy of life. He is a seeker of truth par excellence. He staked all that he had for the search. He traveled far and wide. Almost the whole known world of those days, in search of the masters, of the mystery schools, of any hidden secrets from Greece. He went to Egypt in search of the last Atlantis and its secrets. In Egypt, the great library of Alexandria was still intact. It had all the secrets of the past preserved. It was the greatest library that has ever existed on the earth. Later on, it was destroyed by a Mohammedan fanatic. The library was so big, then when it was burnt for 6 months, the fire continued. Just 25 centuries before Pythagoras, a great continent, Atlantis, has disappeared into the ocean. The ocean that is called Atlantic is called because of that continent Atlantis. Atlantis was the ancient most continent of the earth, and civilization has reached to the highest possible peaks. But whenever civilization reaches to a great peak, there is a danger, the danger of falling apart, the danger of committing suicide. Humanity is facing that same danger again. When man becomes powerful, he does not know what to do with that power.
when the power is too much and the understanding is too little.
Power has always proved dangerous. Atlantis was not drowned into the ocean by any natural calamity. It was actually the same thing that is happening today. It was man's own power over nature. It was through atomic energy that Atlantis was drowned. It was man's own suicide. But all the scriptures and all the secrets of the Atlantis were still preserved in Alexandria. All over the world there are parables, stories about the great flood. Those stories have come from the drowning of Atlantis. All those stories, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, they all talk about a great flood that had come once in the past and has destroyed almost the whole civilization. Just a few initiates, adepts, had survived. Noah is an adept, a great master. And Noah's ark is just a symbol. Few people escape the calamity. With them, all the secrets that the civilization has attained survived. They were preserved in Alexandria. Pythagoras lived in Alexandria for years. He studied, he was initiated in the mystery schools of Egypt, particularly the mysteries of Hermes. Then he came to India, was initiated into all that the Brahmins of this ancient land had discovered. All that India has known into the inner world of man. For years he was in India. Then he traveled to Tibet and then to China. That was the whole known world. His whole life he was a seeker, a pilgrim, in search of a philosophy. Philosophy in the true sense of the word. Love for wisdom. He was a lover, a philosopher, not in the modern sense of the word, but in the old, ancient sense of the word. Because a lover cannot only speculate, a lover cannot only think about truth, a lover has to search, risk, adventure. Truth is the beloved. How can you go on only thinking about it? You have to be connected with the beloved through the heart. The search cannot be only intellectual. It has to be deep down intuitive. Maybe the beginning has to be intellectual, but only the beginning. Just the starting point has to be intellectual, but finally It has to reach to the very core of your being. He was one of the most generous of men. Most liberal, democratic, unprejudiced, open. He was respected all over the world, from Greece to China. He was revered. He was accepted in every mystic school. With great joy he was welcomed everywhere. His name was known in all the lands. Wherever he went, he was received with great rejoicing. Even though he had become enlightened, he still continued to reach to hidden secrets. He still continued to ask to be initiated into new schools. He was trying to create a synthesis. He was trying to know the truth through as many possibilities as humanly is possible. He wanted to know truth in all its aspects, in all its dimensions. He was always ready to bow down to a master. He himself was an enlightened man. It is very rare. Once you have become enlightened, the search stops, the seeking disappears. There is no point. Buddha became enlightened, then he never went to any other master. Jesus became enlightened, then he never went to any other master. Our Laos, our Zarathustra, our Moses. Hence, Pythagoras is something unique. No parallel has ever existed. Even after becoming enlightened, he was ready to become a disciple to anybody who was there to reveal some aspect of truth. His search was such that he was ready to learn from anybody. He was an absolute disciple. He was ready to learn from the whole existence. He remained open. And he remained a learner to the very end. The whole effort was, and it was a great effort in those days, to travel from Greece to China. It was full of dangers. The journey was hazardous. It was not easy as it is today. Today things are so easy. That you can take your breakfast in New York and your lunch in London and you can suffer indigestion in Pune. Things are very simple. In those days, it was not so simple. It was really a risk to move from one country to another country. It took years. By the time Pythagoras reached back, he was a very old man. But seekers gathered around him. A great school was born. And as it always happens, the society started persecuting him and his school and his disciples. His whole life he searched for the perennial philosophy, and he had found it. He has gathered all fragments into a tremendous harmony, into a great unity. But he was not allowed to work it in details, to teach to people. He was not allowed. He was persecuted from one place to another. Many attempts were made on his life. It was almost impossible for him to teach all that he has gathered. And his treasure was immense. In fact, nobody else has ever been with such a treasure as he was. But this is how the foolish humanity is and has always been. This man has done something impossible. He had bridged east and west. He was the first bridge. He had come to know the eastern mind as deeply as the western mind. He was a Greek. He was brought up with the Greek logic, with the Greek scientific approach, and then he moved to the East. And then he learned the ways of intuition. Then he learned how to be a mystic. He himself was a great mathematician in his own right. And a mathematician becoming a mystic is a revolution, because these are poles apart. The West represents the male mind, aggressive intellect. The East represents the female mind, the receptive intuition. The East and the West are not just arbitrary. The division is very, very significant and profound. And you should not forget Rudyard Kipling. What he has said has significance, has meaning. He says East and West shall never meet. There is a fragment of truth in it, because the meeting seems to be impossible. The ways of their working are so diametrically opposite. The West is aggressive, scientific, ready to conquer nature. The East is non-aggressive, receptive, ready to be conquered by nature. The West is eager to know. The East is patient. The West takes every initiative to reach to the mysteries of life and existence. It tries to unlock the doors. And the East simply waits in profound trust that whenever I am worthy, the truth will be revealed to me. West is concentration of the mind. East is meditation of the mind. West is thinking. East is non-thinking. West is mind, East is no mind. And Kipling seems to be logically right that it seems impossible that East and West should ever meet. And the East and West does not only represent that the earth is divided in two hemispheres, they represent your mind too, your brain too. Your brain is also divided in two hemispheres, just like the earth. Your brain has an east in it and a west in it. The left side hemisphere of your brain is west. It is connected with the right hand. And the right side hemisphere of your brain is the east. It is connected with the left hand. The west is rightist. The east is leftist. And the processes of both are so different. The left hemisphere of your mind calculates, thinks, is logical. All science is produced by it. And the right hemisphere of your brain is a poet, is a mystic. It intuits. It feels. It is vague, cloudy, misty. Nothing is clear. Everything is a kind of chaos. But that chaos has its beauty. There is great poetry in that chaos. There is great song in that chaos. It is very juicy. The calculative mind is a desert-like phenomenon, and the non-calculative mind is a garden. Birds sing there and flowers bloom. It is a totally different world. Pythagoras was the first man to try the impossible, and he succeeded. In him, East and West became one. In him, yin and yang became one. In him, male and female became one. He was an Ardhanarishwar, a total unity of the polar opposites. Shiva and Shakti together. Intellect of the highest caliber, an intuition of the deepest caliber. Pythagoras is a peak, a sunlit peak, and a deep dark valley too. It is a very rare combination. But his whole life's effort was destroyed by the stupid people, by the mediocre masses. These few verses are the only contribution left. These verses can be written on one postcard. This is all that is left of that great man's effort, endeavors. And this too is not written by his own hand. It seems all that he had written was destroyed. The day Pythagoras died, his thousands of disciples were massacred and burned. Who Only one disciple escaped the school. His name was Lysis. And he escaped not to save his life. He escaped just to save something of the master's teachings. These golden verses of Pythagoras were written by Lysis, the only disciple who survived. The whole school was burnt, and thousands of disciples were simply murdered and butchered. And all that Pythagoras has accumulated in his journeys, great treasures, great scriptures from China, Tibet, India, Egypt, years and years of work, all was burnt. Lysis wrote these few verses, and as it has been the ancient tradition that a real disciple knows no other name than his master's. That's why these verses are not called Lysis verses, they are called golden verses of Pythagoras. He has not written his name on them. This has been happening again and again. It happened with Vyas in India, a great master. In his name there are so many scriptures that is impossible that one man can write so many scriptures. It is humanly impossible. Even if 1,000 persons write their whole lives continuously, then too so many scriptures cannot be written. Then what happened? They are all authored by Vyas. They are not written all by Vyas, but by his disciples. But the real disciple knows no other name than his master's. He has disappeared in the master. So whatsoever he writes in the name of the master. So many theories have been evolved by linguists, by scholars, by professors. They think there have been so many Vyases, many people of the same name. That is all nonsense. There has been only one Vyas. But down the centuries, many people loved him so deeply that when they wrote something, they felt it is the master writing through them. They have signed master's name because they were only vehicles, just instruments, mediums. The same happened in Egypt to Hermes. Many scriptures, all written by the disciples. And the same happened with Orpheus in Greece. And the same with Lao Tzu in China and Confucius in China. The disciple loses his identity. He becomes utterly one with the master. But something of immense value has been destroyed by the stupidity. Pythagoras is the first experiment in creating a synthesis. 25 centuries have passed since then. Nobody else has tried it again. Nobody else before had done. And nobody else has done it afterwards either. It needs a mind who is both scientific and mystic. It is a rare phenomenon. It happens once in a while. There have been great mystics, Buddha, Lao Tzu, Zarathustra, and there have been great scientists, Newton, Edison, Einstein. But to find a man who is at home with both the worlds, easily at home, is very difficult. Pythagoras is that kind of man. A class unto himself, he cannot be categorized by anybody else. The synthesis that he had tried was needed, particularly in his days, as it is needed today, because the world is again at the same point. The world moves in a wheel. The Sanskrit word for the world is sansar. Sansar means the wheel. The wheel is big. One circle is completed in 25 centuries. 25 centuries before Pythagoras, Atlantis committed suicide. Out of man's own scientific growth, but without wisdom, scientific growth is dangerous. It is giving a sword in the hands of a child. Now, 25 centuries have passed since Pythagoras. Again, the world is in a chaos. Again, the wheel has come to the same point. It always comes to the same point. It takes 25 centuries for this movement to happen. After each 25 centuries, the world comes into a state of great chaos. Man becomes uprooted. He starts feeling meaningless. All the values of life disappear. A great darkness surrounds. Sense of direction is lost. One simply feels accidental. There seems to be no purpose, no significance. Life seems to be just a byproduct of chance. It seems existence does not care for you. It seems there is no life after death. It seems whatsoever you do is futile, routine, mechanical. All seems to be pointless. These times of chaos, disorder, can either be a great curse, as it happened in Atlantis, or they can prove a quantum leap in human growth. It depends how we use them. It is only in such great times of chaos that great stars are born. Pythagoras was not alone. In Greece, Pythagoras and Heraclitus was born. In India, Buddha and Mahavira and many more others. in China, Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, Confucius, Mencius, Li Tzu, and many more. In Iran, Zarathustra. In the Brahmin tradition, many great Upanishadic seers. In the world of Judaism, Moses. These all people, these great masters were born at a certain stage of human history, 25 centuries before. Now we are again in a great chaos, and man's fate will depend what we do. Either we will destroy ourselves like the civilization that destroyed itself in Atlantis, the whole world will become a Hiroshima, we will be drowned in our own knowledge, in our own science, we will commit suicide, a collective suicide. Maybe few, and Noah and few of his followers may be saved, or may not be, or there is a possibility that we can take a quantum leap. Either man can commit suicide, or man can be reborn. Both doors are open. If the times can create people like Heraclitus and Lao Tzu and Zarathustra and Pythagoras and Buddha and Confucius, why not they can create a great humanity? They can. But we go on missing the opportunity. The ordinary masses live in such unconsciousness. They can't see even few steps ahead. They are blind. And they are the majority. The coming 25 years, last part of this century, is going to be of immense value. If we can create a great momentum in the world for meditation, for inward journey, for tranquility, for stillness, for love, for God, if we can create a space in these 25 coming years for God to happen to many, many people, the humanity will have a new birth, a resurrection. A new man will be born. And once you miss these times, then for 25 centuries again, you will remain the same. Few people will achieve to enlightenment, but it will remain only for few people. Here and there, once in a while, a person will become alert and aware and divine. But the greater part of humanity goes on lagging behind in darkness, in utter darkness, in absolute misery. The greater part of humanity goes on living in hell. But these moments, when chaos spreads and man loses his roots with the past, becomes unhinged with the past, are great moments. If we can learn something from the past history, if we can learn something from Pythagoras, People could not use Pythagoras and his understanding. They could not use his great synthesis. They could not use the doors that he had made available. A single individual has done something immense, something impossible, but it was not used. I am trying to do exactly the same again. I feel a very deep spiritual affinity with Pythagoras. I am also bringing you a synthesis of East and West, of science and religion, of intellect and intuition, of the male mind and the female mind, of the head and the heart, of the right and the left. I am also trying in every possible way to create a great harmony, because only that harmony can save. Only that harmony can give you a new birth. But there is every possibility that what was done to Pythagoras will be done to me. And there is every possibility what was done to Pythagoras' followers will be done to my sannyasins. But still, the effort has to be made again. Because this is valuable time. It comes only in 25 centuries once. When the wheel can move in a new way, can take a new direction. You all have to risk. And you have to risk all that you have. And risk it with great joy. Because what can be more joyous than to give birth to a new man, to become vehicles for a new man, for a new humanity? It is going to be painful, as every birth is painful. But the pain can be welcomed if you understand what is going to happen through it. If you can see the child coming out of it, then the pain is no more pain. Just as the mother can accept the pain of the child's birth, the pain is irrelevant. Her heart is dancing with joy. She is going to give birth to life. She is being creative. She is making this world more alive. A new child is being born through her. God has used her as a vehicle. Her womb has proved fertile. She is happy, in great joy. She rejoices, although the pain is there on the periphery. But when this great joy is there, the pain simply functions as a background and makes the joy even more loud. Remember, my sannyasins can become an energy womb, an energy field. A great synthesis is happening here. East and West are meeting here. And if we can make this impossible thing happen, man will live in a totally different way in the future. He will not need to live in the same old hell. Man can live in love, in peace. Man can live in great friendliness. Man can live a life which is nothing but a celebration. Man can make this earth divine. Yes, this very earth can become the paradise, and this very body the Buddha. The sutras, they are few. Pythagoras' sutras are divided in three parts. They are known as three famous pieces of Pythagoras: preparation, purification, perfection. Preparation means getting ready into a receptive mood, becoming available, opening up. Preparation means creating a thirst, a longing for truth. Preparation means not only curious, not only intellectually interested in what truth is, but committed to the search. Not just as a speculator standing outside, but a participant. Preparation is the introductory part to create a great thirst in you. Whenever you come close to a master, the first thing that he is going to give you is a fiery thirst. A great longing he will give to you. He will sow the seeds of great longing. In fact, he will make you very discontented. You may have come to him in search of contentment. You may have come to him to be consoled, but he will make you a flame, a fire, with a new desire that you have not even dreamt about, of which you have never been aware. Maybe it was lurking there somewhere in the dark nooks and corners of your being, are hiding in some recesses, underground. He will bring it forth into light. He will provoke it into a great fire. He will pour all his energy into you to make you so thirsty, so discontented, that you start the search and you become ready to risk all. That you forget all about others' desires. That you pour all your desires into one stream. That your only desire day and night becomes truth, our God, our Nirvana. Those are just names for the same phenomenon. Preparation means the disciple is being awakened. Awakened to the truth that we are existing in darkness and light has to be searched and sought. awakened to the fact that we have been wasting our life, that this is not the right way to live. Unless one starts moving towards God, a life remains empty, impotent. The disciple has to be sogged, shaken out of his dreams of money and power, politics and prestige. And he has to be given a new dream, the ultimate dream, in which all dreams will be consumed. The ultimate dream is to know truth, to know that which is, to know that from which we come, to know that source, and to know that goal to which we are going. Then the second part is purification. When the desire has arisen, then you have to be purified. Because to reach to the ultimate truth, you will have to drop much unnecessary weight, much luggage that you have always carried. You have carried it because you have been thinking it is very valuable. Your system has to be purified of all the toxic things that you have absorbed on the way. And we have been drinking poison. Many kinds of poisons. One is a Hindu, another is a Mohammedan, another is a Christian. These are all poisons, prejudices. They keep you tethered to the society, to the conditionings of the society. Purification means one has to drop all conditionings, all ideologies, all prejudices, all concepts, all philosophies that have been taught by others to you. One has to become a clean slate, a tabula rasa. One has to become utterly clean. Only when you are utterly clean, nothing is written on you, God can write something. Only when you are utterly silent and all words given by the society has disappeared, God can speak to you. Truth can whisper its mysteries into your ears only when you are absolutely empty. Emptiness is purity. Purification is a purgative part. Man has to drop many things. In fact, truth is not far away. Just many things you have accumulated around yourself. You have grown many layers around yourself, many personalities around yourself, many masks you are wearing. Hence you cannot see your original face. All those masks have to be dropped. You have to become authentic, truly as you are, utterly naked as you are. Purification means stop hiding, stop lying, stop being phony. And third is perfection. When you have stopped being phony, when you have dropped all the poisons that you had gathered on the way, when the dust is cleaned off the mirrors, then perfection starts happening on its own accord. Perfection is the unitive part, unio mystica. first the desire, intense desire, a total desire. Because only if you are totally desirous of truth, then you will be ready to go through the pains of purification. If the desire is lukewarm, you will not be ready to go through the pains of purification. It is painful to be purified. It is like taking pus out of your body. It hurts. Although it is good in the long run, if the pus is out, the poison is out, and you will heal soon. But it hurts. To take the pus out is painful. But to leave it inside is to help it to grow. It will spread all over your body. One can be ready only to go through purification if the desire is so total that one is ready to die for it, even if that is needed. And it is a kind of death, because the person that you have always thought you are will have to die. You will have to drop all that you are identified with. And that has been your ego. You will have to surrender all that you have been claiming up to now and bragging up to now. All that has been precious to you has to be dropped as utter rubbish. It is painful. It feels as if you are losing your kingdom and you are becoming a beggar. Unless the desire is total, you will not be ready to do it. And when purification has happened, when you have dropped all that is non-essential, then the essential perfects itself. You need not become perfect. You have only to create the space in which perfection grows, happens. Perfection is a happening. The first sutra, preparation, render to the immortal gods the consecrated cult, guard then thy faith. Lord Bacon, a great scientific mind, has written in his famous book Novum Organum that Pythagoras was a great fanatic. Now this is utter nonsense. Bacon's book is really great, except this one statement. The book is of immense value. It is said that there are three great books in the world. First is Aristotle's Organum. Organum means principle. The second is Bacon's Novum Organum, new principle. And third is Ospensky's Tertium Organum, the third principle. And they are really great books, incomparable. But it is very surprising how Bacon concluded that Pythagoras is a fanatic. Because Pythagoras is just the opposite, the absolute opposite of a fanatic. If he had been a fanatic, he would not have entered into all kinds of esoteric, occult schools. If he was a fanatic, she would not have been so open to learn from every possible source. In fact, fanaticism has never been part of Greek minds. The philosophic mind cannot be fanatic, cannot be dogmatic. That is a prerequirement of philosophy, that you have to be open, that you have to inquire, that you have to doubt, that you have to question, and that you have to remain available to truth in whatsoever form it comes. That you are not to decide beforehand, that you have not to fall in that kind of attitudes which has already concluded without knowing. You are not to be a victim of the fallacy of a priorism that you have already accepted from the very beginning without inquiring, without knowing, without experiencing. I have tried hard why Bacon should call Pythagoras a fanatic. Fanaticism came out of the Judaic mind. It was never part of the Hindu mind, or the Chinese mind, or the Greek mind. It came out of Jews. And it spread into Christians and Mohammedans because both are offshoots of Judaism. The idea that we are the chosen people of God is dangerous. It creates fanaticism. The idea that we have the truth and nobody else is dangerous. That there is only one God and no other gods is dangerous. Because that one God is going to be my God. And then what will happen to your God? Then you are wrong. Then you are a sinner. Then you have to be persuaded, converted. If you allow easily, okay. Otherwise, you have to be forced and coerced, so that you can drop the wrong God. Pythagoras lived in so many countries, with so many different visions of life, with so many philosophical standpoints, with so many religions. He cannot be a fanatic. It seems Bacon knows nothing about Pythagoras. The first sutra says, render to the immortal gods. He does not use the word God, but gods. That is significant. That is the state of a non-fanatic mind. Gods. Why plural? Why not gods? Because the moment you say gods, you are falling into the dangerous trap. Then what will happen to other people's gods? Pythagoras is not a monotheist. He does not believe in one God. He says, all the peoples of the world and all their approaches are true. And he knows it because he has followed many, many paths. Almost all existent paths Pythagoras followed. And he always reached to the same peak. there are many paths to reach to the peak. The mountain has many paths, but they all reach to the same peak. You can go from the south or from the north or from the east or from the west. You can follow a very rocky track or you can follow a very different track. There are many alternatives. Pythagoras knows truth is one, but he does not say. Truth is one unsaid. Once you say it, then please don't use the singular. Then it is better to use the plural. The Vedas say truth is one, but wise people have described it in many ways. Render to the immortal gods the consecrated cult. He had lived with many people, worshippers of different gods. He says to his disciples, when you go to the temple, worship the god of the temple. And worship the way people are worshipping there. Respect the people who are worshipping and praying. And when you go to the mosque, worship the way people are worshipping there. And when you go to the church or the synagogue, worship the way people are worshipping there. This is my approach too. All prayers are good. All prayers reach to him. And all paths ultimately end in him. There is no need to create any antagonism. To my sannyasins, this is my message. If you want a silent, isolated place, a temple or a church or a mosque, then whichever is close by, enter there. All temples and all churches and all mosques are yours. Claim. That whichever place is dedicated to God is ours. Jerusalem and Kaaba and Kailas and Girnar, all are ours. I give you all the temples of the world as yours and all the scriptures of the world as yours. Pythagoras is saying to his disciples, wherever you are, watch the people, respect their prayer, respect their gods, respect their vision. It may be only one aspect, but it is an aspect of God himself. It may be only one face. God has many faces. All the manifestations are his. In one way, he descends in Krishna. In another, he descends in Christ. In still another, he descends into Moses. All prophets are his. All messengers are his. Render to the immortal gods the consecrated cult. And whatsoever you believe, don't just believe it, consecrate it, make it holy by living. Let it not just remain an intellectual belief in the head. It has to become existential, then it is consecrated. Then you have made it holy and sacred. beliefs, if they are only thoughts, are useless unless they become your very blood, bones and marrow. Unless you live them. If you feel something is true, live it. Because that will be the only proof that you feel it is true. There is no other proof. Only your life is a proof of your belief. But that does not mean that impose a belief upon yourself. That does not mean that force a belief and a character upon yourself. That will not be making it sacred. That will be hypocrisy. And how hypocrisy can be sacred? Live it not from the without towards the within, but just the opposite, from the within towards the without. First experience a truth. For example, I say meditate. Now you can make it just a belief that it is good to meditate, that meditation contains great truths, that you can now argue with others about the beauties, about the mysteries of meditation. You have never meditated yourself. And you don't have time enough because of the arguments and the thinking about and reading about meditation. And you have completely forgotten that meditation has to be tasted, not to be argued. Or you can impose violently some meditative posture upon yourself. You can sit silently like a Buddha, although there is no Buddhahood inside, no silence, no purity, no innocence. The inner talk continues, but on the surface you can sit like a stone statue. This is hypocrisy. You are simply pretending. This is not the way to consecrate. This is not the way to make something sacred. You have to really go into meditation, not to pretend. And whenever you live a truth, the truth becomes consecrated. Render to the immortal gods the consecrated cult. And whatsoever you have known, offer it to God. Go on offering it to God, whatsoever you have known. Whatsoever experience has happened to you of truth, of beauty, of love, go on offering it to God. Go on offering in deep gratitude. Guard then thy faith, but don't tell it to people. Guard it. Offer it to the God, but don't talk about it. Otherwise, you will be in danger. The masses are foolish. They cannot understand. It is beyond them. Guard. Keep it secret deep down in your heart. Open your heart to the gods. Open your heart to your master, or open your heart to the friends who are following the same path, the fellow travelers, the fellow seekers. But don't open your heart in the marketplace. You will be misunderstood. And the misunderstanding will create disturbance for you. It will distract your search. It will disrupt your energies. It will create turmoil in you. truths can be communicated only to people who have some understanding. Guard then thy faith, and whatsoever trust has arisen in you, whatsoever faith is born in you, keep it secret. It has to become a seed in your heart. Just if you throw the seed on the ground, it will not grow into a tree because it is open. It has to go deep into the womb of the earth, in the darkness of the earth. There it will disappear, dissolve, and a tree will be born. Whatsoever trust has arisen in you, let it become a seed in your heart. Let it disappear into the soil of the heart. There it will grow into a big tree. Yes, one day it will happen that you will not be able to contain it anymore. But then what can you do? Till you can contain it. Till you can keep it a secret, keep it a secret. Just like the child in the mother's womb for 9 months remains secret. But one day the mother cannot contain it. The child has grown. Now the child is ready to be born. Then it is perfectly okay. Why? Pythagoras is saying it. Why? In the first sutra, for a certain reason. Because whenever you have a little glimpse of truth, the mind tends to talk about it. And in that very talking, you lose it. It is like an abortion. Let it remain for 9 months a secret, a mystery, known only to yourself. Are your beloveds? Are few friends? But not to the public. It is a private phenomenon. Yes, one day it is going to become public. One day you will not be able to contain it anymore. It has become so big, bigger than you, that it has to overflow. When it starts overflowing, it is another matter. You become a master then. But till that moment arrives, be very guarded, be very watchful. Don't talk about your inner experiences to each and everybody. Keep alert, because truth is very difficult to get hold of, and it is very easy to lose track of it. Trust is very difficult to be born in, and very easy to dissipate it. Revere the memory of the illustrious heroes of spirits, demigods. First, render to the immortal gods the consecrated cult. Then guard thy faith. Second sutra, remember all those who have attained before you. Cherish their memory. That will help you on the way. There will be many moments when suspicion will arise. Doubts will arise. There will be long, long dark nights of the soul when you will feel utterly lost, when you will start thinking of going back and being just the ordinary person you had been before. In those moments, river the memory of the Buddhas, river the memory of all those great heroes who have attained to truth. In Pythagoras' language, the hero means one who has become enlightened, who has attained the truth. The only heroic deed in life is to become realized. All else is very ordinary. You can become very famous. It is very easy. You can have political power. It does not need much intelligence. You can earn money. You have only to be a little cunning and calculative. These are not great things. The only great thing that makes a life great and sublime is to know truth, is to know God, is to be truth, is to be God. But the journey is very alone. River the memory of the illustrious heroes of Buddha, of Lao Tzu, of Krishna, of Christ, of Moses, of Muhammad, of Mahatma. Remember. That's why I'm talking on so many masters, so you can remember that you are not alone on the path. Many have succeeded before you. You will also succeed. If so many have succeeded, why not you? Many have preceded you and reached. You are not moving alone. Many are ahead of you. It is a long procession of truth seekers. You are part of a great chain. You may be a small drop, but you are part of a great river. The river of Buddhas, of all the enlightened people of the world. That's why I am talking about so many enlightened people. To give you courage. To give you confidence. To give you the sense that you are in a great chain, part of a golden chain, and you are moving not alone. There is no need to be afraid. You cannot be lost. River the memory of the illustrious heroes, of spirits, demigods. One who attains to God becomes a demigod, becomes a God himself. One who has known him has become him. Cherish the memory. Remind yourself. And find out with whom you feel affinity. Do you feel affinity with Moses? Do you feel affinity with Zarathustra? If you feel some affinity, then the best way is to ponder over the sayings of Zarathustra or Moses. Meditate. Think of their life. Create an climate around yourself. Because if you feel affinity with somebody, that means you are of the same type. And it is not a question of your accidental birth. You may be born a Mohammedan and you may not feel any affinity with Muhammad. There is no necessity. Birth is accidental. You may be born a Hindu and you may not feel any affinity with Krishna, or even a certain antagonism. You may not be the type. So don't be too much identified with your birth. Roam around. Have a little more freedom. Look around. Whichever flower attracts you, follow that. Whichever fragrance calls you, follow that fragrance. So you may be a Hindu by birth, but if you feel that Quran simply rings bells in your heart, then Quran is your scripture. Forget all about Hinduism. Then Muhammad is your man. Forget all about Krishna. You may be born a Mohammedan, but if seeing the statue of Buddha, something immediately settles in you, becomes serene, calm and cool. Just the name of Buddha, and you feel great love arising in you for this unknown, mysterious person, then forget all about Mohammedanism and Quran and Muhammad. Then create the climate of Buddha around you, because that will be helpful, that will nourish you, that will strengthen you. The second part, purification. This was preparation. Respect all the gods of the world, all the temples, all the sacred places. Respect all the scriptures. This is your respect for other human beings. And remember with great love all those who have preceded you on the path and have reached. This will prepare, climate you, and this will create a great desire in you. This will become a longing. And you will be gripped by the longing. You will be possessed by the longing. If Buddha has touched your heart, a great longing is bound to arise. How to become a Buddha? If Christ has been felt at the deepest core of your being, then it is bound to happen that you will start working, searching how to become a Christ, how to attain to Christ consciousness. Once the desire is there, then purification is possible. The second part, purification. Be a good son, just brother, spouse tender and good father. You will be surprised by this sutra, but it is of immense value. Be a good son and a just brother and a spouse tender and a good father. You will think what it has to do with his spirituality. It has to do much. You have to create a peaceful surrounding. Only then you can fall into meditation. You have to create an atmosphere, an energy field. Only then you can go inwards. In Gurdjieff's school in Fontainebleau, it was written on the gate, "If you have not settled your accounts with your father, go back. First settle your accounts with your father, then come. Unless you respect your father, there is no possibility of your growing." It's strange. Why? What it has to do with the search? And from another corner, there is psychoanalysis which says, settle your accounts with your mother. Unless that is settled, you will never feel settled. You will remain tense. The whole psychoanalytic work is how to close accounts between you and your mother gracefully, lovingly. Pythagoras seems to be the first to say it exactly, simply. Be a good son. What does it mean to be a good son? Does it mean to be a slave, utterly obedient? If you are a slave, you are not a good son. If you are utterly obedient, you are a hypocrite. Then what does it mean to be a good son? If you ask people, they will say, good son means do whatsoever of your father says. It is not that simple. Because you can do it from the outside and you can resist it from the inside. That's what children have to do. They are helpless. Whatsoever the parents say, they have to do it willingly, unwillingly, reluctantly. They have to do it. That creates a split in them. They become two. They start becoming false, phony. So one way is ordinarily thought that just be obedient to the father and you are a good son. That is not the meaning of Pythagoras. Then does he mean rebel against the father? Go against him? Do just the opposite whatsoever he says? Be a hippie or ippie or something? If he says have short hairs, then have long hairs. If he says take a bath every day, then forget all about taking bath for years. If he says cleanliness is next to God, then be dirty and claim that dirtiness is next to God. No, that too is not the meaning of being a good son. In fact, the second thing has happened in the world because the first has persisted too long. Too much enforced obedience has created reaction. Then who is a good son? A good son is one who is alert, understanding, respectful, who listens to the father, because the father knows much. He has lived. He has experienced life. He has more experience. He listens to the father. He tries to understand the father. He is open.
He is not in a hurry either to obey or to disobey. A good son is one who is ready to listen, to understand, to learn. And then, if you feel that you agree with the father, do it. If you feel you don't agree with the father, then say it. There is no question of reaction. Just make it plain that you don't agree. You will do, but it will be done with forced effort. It will make you phony. If the father wants, you will do it, but it will make you phony. It will make you split, schizophrenic. It will divide you. A good communion is needed between the father and the son, because the father represents the past and the son represents the future. A bridge is needed. And it cannot be one-sided. So it is not only for the son to be a good son. The final thing is to be a good father too. He is creating a family atmosphere in which meditation can grow easily. A good son is one who is alert, ready to obey the father when he feels he is right, ready to say to the father that I am not willing to do it. It will be false, it will be phony. And ready to go with the father if he cannot decide on his own. Because there may be things which you cannot feel either right or wrong, then follow the father. He knows better. And the father simply represents the past. The father simply represents all father figures. All those who are elder than you, older than you. The father is simply a symbol of all those who have lived more than you, experienced more than you. The teachers, the elders. A great respect is needed. Respect for their life, respect for their experience. There is no need to become a slave and there is no need to react against them. Understanding is needed, neither obedience nor reaction. And out of understanding, if obedience comes, it is beautiful. And out of understanding, if sometimes rebellion comes, it is beautiful. But it has to come out of understanding, not out of reaction. There are people who will not do a certain thing because their father says to do it. How can they do it? Just because the father is saying they cannot do it, they will do the opposite. Their egos are in conflict. And there are people who know that it is wrong, but they will do it because the father says. Both are wrong. The good son is one who listens to the father, to all father figures. Tries to understand with great respect, with openness, with no conclusions, and then whatsoever decision arises in his being, to follow or not to follow, he goes with it. It is neither reaction nor obedience. It is simply acting out of understanding. Be a just brother. with all those who are of your age. Be just. Don't be unfair. Don't exploit. Because if you exploit, you create a tension around yourself. Create friendship around yourself. Because growth will be easier in a friendly atmosphere. Espouse tender. With your wife, with your husband, be tender. Be soft. Because love has the other side of hate in it. And unless you understand what it means to be tender, soft, loving, there is every possibility love bring great hate in you. People love the same person and the same person they hate. And that hate destroys all love, poisons all possibilities of love. And love is a great phenomenon. The person who has missed love will never know what prayer is. Will never be able to pray. It is only love's experience that prepares you to pray. Be a spouse tender. Be a spouse tender. Love the woman or the man with great tenderness, grace that has disappeared from the world. People's relationship has become very ungraceful. They have lost the whole language of tenderness. Their love life is so full of hate and anger and rage that may be one of the causes why God has become dead in this century. Love has disappeared, prayer cannot arise. Love is the flower, prayer is the fragrance. If the flower is not there, then there cannot be any fragrance. And good father, and in your own turn, circle is complete. Be a good father. What does it mean to be a good father? Don't enforce anything on your child. Give your love. Give your understanding. But always make it clear that the choice is the child's. If he wants to follow it, he can follow. But he is following his choice. If he wants not to follow, he is free not to follow. Again, he is following his choice. Make everything clear to the child. You love him. So give your experience to him, but don't enforce it. Don't command. Let him understand. Let understanding be the only law. And let him follow his understanding. Now you can understand. The father has to be just a helper. The father has not to mold the child in a certain pattern that he wants. He has not to use the child for his own ambitions. He has to love the child, make him strong, make him more alert, so that he can search his own ways in life, make him more and more independent. The good father does not cripple the child, does not force the child to depend on him. And if there is a good father, naturally the son will be good. because he will not be enforced into any slavery, and he will not have to react either. And if you have been a good son, in your own turn one day you will become a father, and you will be a good father. This is the family atmosphere, the space in which we live. This space has to be of intimacy, of love, of grace. Only then meditation will be easier, and spiritual growth will be enhanced. Choose for thy friend the friend of virtue. Yield to his gentle counsels, profit by his life, and for a trifling grievance never leave him. Friendship has also disappeared from the world. What you call friendship has nothing to do with the ancient idea of friendship. Your friendship is just accidental. You work in the same office, so you have become friendly. Or you study in the same college, so you become friendly. This is not real friendship. Pythagoras says, choose thy friend. You cannot choose your father. You cannot choose your mother. You cannot choose your family. But you can choose your friend. You can choose your woman. You can choose your man. That too is an extension of friendship. Choose for thy friend the friend of virtue, one who has some grace, who has some flowering, who has some quality around him, who has an energy field of virtue. By virtue is not mean the righteous, no. Not the holier than thou, no. By virtue is meant one in whose company you suddenly start feeling a tremendous well-being. In whose company, in whose vibe, something starts dancing in you. Whose presence helps you to soar high. Choose a friend. And then ultimately you will be able to choose a master, because master is the ultimate friend. If you cannot choose friends, you will not be able to choose the master either. Choose good friends, and then one day you will be able to choose the ultimate friend. Yield to his gentle counsels, profit by his life. And when you choose a friend, listen to his counsels. He will not enforce them. They will be gentle whisperings. He will not be very loud. He will not argue. He will not command. He will only suggest. He will only hint. He will only indicate. And that is the case with the ultimate friend, the master. Buddha says, Buddhas only point the way. They don't make it very loud, because they don't want to be violent. They don't want you to drag according to themselves. They have no desire to dominate you. They simply express whatsoever they have known and understood. Now it is up to you to follow or not to follow, and learn from his life, be profited by his life, not only his words, but see the way the friend lives, see his actual life and watch it. This is the only way to learn in life. People are scriptures. You have to learn how to read the language. People are great secrets. Each person is carrying a great secret. If you know how to listen to it, you will be tremendously benefited. And for a trifling grievance, never leave him. If thou canst, at least for a most rigid law, binds power to necessity. Pythagoras says there are two laws. One is of necessity, another is of power. The law of necessity applies to people who are unconscious. People who live mechanically, they live out of necessity. There is another law, higher than necessity, the law of power. The more conscious you become, the more you go out of necessity, you transcend necessity. You start living out of power, out of abundant power. Then your life is not of necessity. For example, a person speaks out of necessity because he cannot resist the temptation to speak. Buddhas also speak, but with no necessity. It is out of power, out of abundant power. They are silent. There is no temptation, no obsession to speak. They can remain silent forever, but still they speak. If they speak, they speak out of power. You love out of necessity. Buddhas also love. They love out of so much energy is there that it has to be shared. So much power is happening, it has to be given. You live out of necessity, they live out of power. Buddhas are the greatest luxury in existence. These two laws are rooted in one primordial law. They are part of one law, two aspects of one law. In China, that law is called Tao. In India, that law is called Dhamma. In Greece, that law is called Logos. Jews have called it Torah. It is the same law. The whole existence is based in one law. But that law has two aspects. One aspect for those who are unconscious, they live like slaves, robots. And another aspect of freedom, of power, of immense joy. That aspect happens only when you are awakened, enlightened. And to have these two laws harmoniously adjusted in your life is the basic message of Pythagoras. When these two laws are in a harmony, you are in harmony. When these two laws are in harmony, then your body follows the law of necessity and your soul follows the law of power. Then your mind follows the law of necessity and your heart follows the law of power. Then you are a meeting of the sky and the earth, body and soul, the visible and the invisible. And that's what Buddhahood is. That's what enlightenment is. Enough for today.